Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Autism Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Kristen Martin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Gwen. Welcome, and thank you for calling into Cigna's Autism Awareness Series. My name is Kristen Martin, and I'm the lead clinician for the autism team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you will be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions on today's presentation. A handout for today's seminar is available online at www.cigna.com/autism. Scroll to the current topic section in the middle of your page and click on today's topic labeled Effective Strategies for Helping Children Learn Social Skills. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information, if your policy covers topics discussed in today's seminar, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Terry Howard. She is a board-certified behavior analyst and has been working with children with special needs for 10 years. She is the co-founder and director of clinical services of South Lake Autism and Behavior Services in Florida. She is a master's level educator, a master's level BCBA, and an autism specialist. She routinely participates in IEP meetings and helps advocate for appropriate services within the school system for children. She is especially interested in anti-bullying programs and their effectiveness. Terry, thank you for being here today. You are welcome to start your presentation.
Thank you, Kristen, and thank you for joining us, the listening audience. So today's topic is on social skills, and as I was preparing for this presentation, I did a lot of searching online to see what information on social skills was actually out there and available to the public. And what I found is that there's a lot of how to teach social skills information available, but what I really found was missing was helping parents and teachers and family members understand the skill deficits and the motivation necessary to actually acquire social skills. So that is going to be the focus of today's presentation. So not so much how to teach social skills, but how to motivate our kids on the spectrum who are deficit in this area. So as most of us know, autism is the most prevalent childhood developmental disorder in the U.S. Over the last 10 years, I have seen this number continue to rise. We're very fortunate that now autism is gaining so much attention, so there is a lot of research and a lot of resources really pouring into autism to help us understand the etiology or the cause a little bit better. One thing about autism is that it just does not have an impact on the child diagnosed with autism, but it affects the lives of everybody, and this includes parents, siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, neighbors, the friends of parents. So it affects everybody as broadly as the spectrum itself affects children. You know, so does it affect the people in their lives. So a quick overview of what we're going to go over is just a quick introduction to what social skills is. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how we can effectively assess where our kid is in terms of their current social ability. Prerequisite skills will be the next area of focus, where we really look at do they have the first step, you know, in developing a social relationship with somebody. So kind of goes back to the initial comment about, you know, not so much focusing on the how-to, but really looking at all of the little steps and the motivation that go into social skills, the actual skill that we see when we're looking at people interacting together. The next area is just the basic skills. So what are the first things? Just getting into the prerequisite skills a little bit better. What does your child have to know how to do first before we can expect these more advanced skills? So an introduction to social skills. So social skills can be defined many different ways, but I try to come up with a single sentence that really encompassed the whole thing. And what I came up with was that it really is a set of listener, speaker, body language, and action skills that allow two or more people to independently interact in a very effective and reciprocal manner in a given environment with actions and skills similar to that of their peers. And we'll get into that a little bit more, but it's really important to just keep in the back of your mind in a manner that is where their actions and their skills are similar to their peers. So what we really want is for these kiddos and their ability to match their age and what they look like and what would really be expected of them. So on to slide number 5. Social skills very much are a natural, necessary component of our life, and without realizing it, many of our daily actions are really comprised of social skills that we've learned in childhood and have perfected throughout the year. And we don't realize so much what an impact these little things are, but most of us, typically developing, have learned to make eye contact and return greetings and attend to a non-preferred conversation that somebody is having. But these are skills that are a little more difficult for our friends on the spectrum. And they're things that really need to be taught. Eye contact is something that we target in therapy quite often. And really teaching kids when to look at somebody, how long to look at someone, when to look away. And the social component of that is, you know, eye contact when we're looking at a speaker, it shows that as a listener, we are acknowledging what they are saying. We are attending to them, even if we're not interested, but we still want to give an indication to the person speaking, the speaker, that we are interested in what they're saying, or we're at least attending to it. Greetings is another skill that most of us have learned to say hi to somebody. A lot of our friends on the spectrum, this is something that has to be taught. They have to learn when to greet, when to say hi, when not to, how many times do I say hi to somebody. And that goes into the social component of just recognizing the needs of others. And when we walk into a room, we have that need to be acknowledged, for somebody to greet us, hi, good morning, good afternoon. Sharing toys. This is another one that most of us learn early on, to share toys. And we have this idea that if we share toys, we know that we will likely get that toy back. Our friends on the spectrum, they don't always realize that. They live in the here and now, and if you take my toy, we mistakenly assume that they know they might get that toy back. And, you know, one of our friends on the spectrum, they might not realize they're going to get that toy back. Giving that toy up or sharing it might mean that toy is gone forever, and they might engage in behaviors that will result in them maintaining that toy in their presence. So that's another area that we, you know, a little prerequisite skill that we'd want to target is helping children understand that if you share a toy, it comes back to you. What's tricky is teaching, you know, how do we teach this kid that sharing does not mean it's gone forever and that sharing can be fun. Another area is conversation skills, and that's a necessary component of just working. So obviously, communication is one of our diagnostic criteria for kiddos on the spectrum, and so it is across the board an area of deficit for a majority of kids on the spectrum. And teaching that particular skill is going to help them later in life when it comes to friendship and work and communicating their needs. Moving on to slide number 6. A lot of us learn skills kind of naturally by watching other people imitating their behaviors. We you know, might see the way that a lady tosses her hair or handwriting of our peers, and if we like that, we might imitate it. And imitation might come very natural for us. For our kids on the spectrum, it's not always a natural, easy skill. It's the teaching imitation is something that has to be taught, just like reading or writing or math. It is a skill that they don't naturally know how to do. They were not born knowing how to do it, and therefore it needs to be taught. Some people have the ability to learn new skills rather quickly, while others must be taught over and over again and learn them more slowly. And the thing that always comes to my mind is back in third grade, where, you know, it took me weeks and weeks and weeks to learn timetables, where the kid next to me had it memorized the very next day. And so for some people, these skills, they're just, it's a lot easier. But for others, it takes a lot more time. For our friends on the spectrum, it generally takes a lot more time to teach these skills. Social learning, especially for our friends on the spectrum or any other developmental disability, it's not always instinctive. So they may struggle in acquiring these skills. They might not understand the purpose of learning a skill and how it's going to help or affect them in the future. Moving on to slide number 7, and it's just, you know, a quick 8-little question survey that you can just take in your mind right now, thinking about your child and looking at their attending skills, the parallel play, the interest that they have in other people, eye contact, their ability to invite others to play or to share or to turn take. And if we're looking at wanting our child to spend 5 minutes or 10 minutes playing a closed-ended game of, let's say, Candyland or Go Fish with a peer, we have to come back to a list like this and realize, do they even have the prerequisite skills to play such a game? So Candyland is a very normal game that generally kids 3 and up can learn to play and would enjoy. And it's a normal thing, quote-unquote. But we have to, again, go back. If a child has the ability to sit for 10 minutes and attend to a single game, then maybe they're ready to learn how to play Candyland. But if they have not even mastered the ability to tolerate the presence of another peer and parallel play side by side, then they're certainly not ready to learn to play Candyland or any other closed-ended game with a peer. Eye contact is another thing that's important. Just continuing with the Candyland example, eye contact is necessary for looking up at peers to see whose turn it is, who's going, who's looking at who to indicate the next person's turn in the circle. And if the child on the spectrum has not mastered these skills or been taught the importance of it, again, they're not likely going to be successful playing a game like Candyland. Moving on to slide number 8, and this is where really the meat of the presentation is for me and what I really want to focus on. And in my experience, I have found working with little kids, you know, age 2, 3, 4, and all the way up into their late 40s, that their past experience always plays a role in how they value the idea of learning a new skill. So I'll give you a couple of examples. We had one child who a caregiver would always say, "You need to share." And they would yank the toy from the child on the spectrum and give it to another child. And this child sat and would cry and watch this other child play with their favorite toy. And the longer the kid on the spectrum sat and cried, the longer the mom allowed the toy to be in the presence of the other kid. And so what happened is every time the mom or a teacher would say, "You need to share that toy," the child would jump up and run away because in the child's mind, they had no idea what share meant, that share is actually a reciprocal thing where I have it and then I give it back to you. For this child, his whole experience had simply been somebody says share, and from his perspective, that means mom comes, yanks my toy away, somebody else gets to play with it, and I don't get it back. So the child had no idea what the word share meant in the sense that perhaps you or I know what, understand what share means. He just meant share means my toy's gone. So you could replace share with any other word, and it would have the same meaning. So these aversive experiences play a role in how kids respond to new experiences. Another example, very recently, is every time one of our kids we were working with got in proximity to another peer, and he was really interested in balls. And so this child would stand on the sideline, and he would watch these other kids kick this ball back and forth, and he would run after the ball because he loves balls. But what he didn't realize is that all these kids would run towards him because it was a game of soccer, and they were running to kick the ball towards the goal, and this kid would end up trampled on and hurt. And so this, what had happened was the soccer ball that he loved was actually paired with pain and became very aversive for him in the presence of peers, because every time he went after the ball to play, as he was instructed by teachers, he got tackled by these other kids and got hurt. So for him, there was no motivation for him to continue to play because over and over again, when he tried to interject and go after the ball in a way that he knew how, he ended up getting hurt. So there's no value there. Why would he want to go out there and play if it just means he's going to get hurt? Because he didn't know how to play soccer. And so he would end up at the back of the playground not wanting to interact with anybody because every time he got near a peer, he ended up getting hurt. And it was just a simple thing as, you know, teaching this kid the rules and teaching other peers outside of a very intense game of soccer how to play and what the objectives were. But he didn't have that skill and developed an aversion to it. So that's past experiences that might affect our motivation to engage in learning a new skill. Another area are skill deficits. So we just talked about that a little bit with this, the deficit of even knowing how to play soccer. But they could also be age-appropriate deficits. So we have another child who loves to play, and this is a 13-year-old child, but loves to play with Sesame Street toys. And so you have a very large 13-year-old going through puberty, and he doesn't know how to play with anything other than Sesame Street toys. That's, you know, that is his narrow and very limited interest. And, of course, kids his age are not interested. And so the idea here is we have to start to think of, you know, what is our kid on the spectrum? What do they like to play with compared to their peers? And how do we get them interested in more age-appropriate toys that's really going to help them gain access to interaction with peers? Obviously, if, you know, he's 13 and he plays with Sesame Street, there's 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old children who like Sesame Street, and those are the type of children that want to interact with him because they have this mutual interest, but highly inappropriate. So another area to look at in motivation. So again, if you know, so you have a kid who's interested in toddler toys, how are we going to get them interested in something that's a little more age appropriate? The other area that affects or just assessing social skill readiness is the narrow interest. So, and this is very common with our friends on the spectrum. They like one thing and they stick with it. So it's really showing them and getting them interested and exposing them to a variety of different things and see what else sparks their interest. There was something about Sesame Street that really sparked the last example's interest, and he really loved it. So if we expose them to a variety of other things, there might be something else that this kid totally gets into, and we can start to fade away the two-year-old toys and start to shape his behavior and teach him skills to interact with things that are a little more age-appropriate. Another area that we have to look at in assessing the readiness for social skills is behaviors that are in excess. And this could be perseverative behaviors. So the idea of the kid who only wants to talk about Star Wars or can't get off one topic and talk about what you want to talk about. They just keep circling around to what their interest is and what they want to talk about. Maladaptive behaviors is another area, and these can be anything from self-injurious behaviors where they will hit or hurt themselves in some way, to property destruction in a classroom, to aggressing with other children. And if they still have a lot of maladaptive behaviors that really interfere with their ability to interact with peers, then we definitely need to think about how we're going to target and decrease these maladaptive behaviors and so that the child is available to interact with peers. Tantrums is another area. Tantrums sometimes can last a long time. They're very loud. Sometimes people get hurt during a tantrum. And if kids are having a lot of tantrums, then we definitely need to figure out why and to make sure that the tantrums are not interfering with their ability to interact with peers. Again, on to slide number 9, aversive experiences. So they play a big role in how we view future behaviors and experiences. If we were attacked by a dog one time in childhood, again, unless we have many, many good experiences with dogs, that one bad aversive experience of being attacked by a dog kind of follows us around, and that's the idea that we carry with us about dogs, whether they're good or bad. The same thing with social experiences. And just like it would take many, many puppy licks and good experiences for us to learn to love dogs or learn to trust dogs, we have to think of these aversive experiences the same way. It's going to take a lot of good experiences to help our kids on the spectrum find value in being around peers or sharing their toys, or not so much wanting to be alone. So what motivates them? So, again, we would avoid dogs. We're motivated to avoid dogs because they've become aversive to us. Kids on the spectrum might be motivated to avoid peers because maybe that signals something aversive. Stealing toys, taking toys, hitting, getting trampled on the soccer field. All of these things seem very benign and normal to us. But from the child's perspective, it might, you know, be a very different story. So here's just a little example on slide 9 about bad social experiences and how they can be traumatic and how it might explain some of the behaviors that we see. Decreased motivation to socialize because peers have been paired as something negative. If you're not motivated to be around peers, well, then that increases the motivation to perhaps being alone or away from peers. And if we're away from peers, then we don't have the opportunity to build those necessary social skills. And again, slide 10 is the idea that we really have to undo these negative experiences so that we change the value that we have to the new experiences. Where we can expect a child to play with another child, we need to make other children more valuable so that there is a motivation to play. Several ways that we can do this, and it might just be that we take a peer and all this peer does for a day or two, maybe a couple hours, maybe it takes a couple of weeks, is be the one that hands the preferred toy to our friend on the spectrum. So often I will take a kid, if I know my spectrum friend loves balls, I'll find a peer who doesn't love balls so much, so that peer doesn't have the motivation to keep the ball, but I'll have this child pick up a ball, and just go give it to the other kid on the spectrum, and then just walk away. And so now if we do this time and time and time again, this child starts to see that good things do come from these peers, and we don't necessarily need to avoid them. So just like the bad, the aversive was conditioned, we can pair lots of good things so that peers are not seen as aversives anymore. Slide 11, again, assessing readiness. And it just gives you another example, a little more grown-up example, of how these aversive experiences really have a value-altering effect on some of our behaviors. So just imagine every time you walked into a store, a young man took your purse, hit you on the head, like anything that would be traumatizing and aversive to you. And perhaps one time or after multiple times of this happening, you'd be on high alert for young men every time you walked into a store. You might even totally avoid going into stores because stores and young men in general have now been associated with you being violated in some way, either being assaulted or having your toys taken or your purse taken. Another thing to look at is how well your child can tolerate environments. So a lot of our kids are hypersensitive to environmental stimuli. So that can be noises, smells, just the quantity of peers, how crowded it is, normal crowd bumps that might be misinterpreted. So it's another thing to look at what environments does your child naturally want to gravitate to, and maybe start to work on making these social settings more in line with what your child naturally enjoys being, and it might open them up to at least not wanting to avoid social settings because they're in a setting that environmentally is in tune with what they like. So slide 12, just again, talks about assessing the readiness of your child to interact socially with peers. And we've already talked about these examples, but just again, we need to work to make positive experiences occur in the presence of peers. So if a child has had a lot of negative experiences happen in the presence of peers, then, you know, negative experiences and peers kind of go hand in hand. So we definitely need to undo that and make good experiences happen in the presence of peers. So the child will start to associate peers with good things happening. And that again, is going to have a value-altering effect, and they'll be motivated to be around kids because good things happen when they're around kids. So social skills is something that I've been teaching for a very long time, and it's a little group exercise that we normally do when we're face-to-face with people. But, you know, when kids are wired differently and social skills are not innate or natural. I mean, they're not innate to any of us. They're all learned behaviors, but it comes less natural and feels very awkward, especially when you're not used to doing it. So here's a little exercise that you can do while you're listening to me. And just cross your arms in the normal way that you would cross them, just right in front of your chest. And then purposefully cross your arms in the opposite way, where the arm that is naturally on top, put that one on bottom and fold the bottom arm up over the top, and just think about how that feels. And it probably feels similar to if you were to write with your opposite hand. It is not natural. It feels weird. And you want to go right back to the way you normally do it. And for our friends on the spectrum, you know, this might be a good way to kind of understand why they do what they do. You know, they go back to the behaviors that work for them. They're effective, they feel natural, they're easy, and they know what to do and they know it's expected. And when we are teaching our friends skills, imagine the effort that it would take to perhaps have you start to write with your other hand. And what would we have to do to motivate you to really want to use that other hand rather than the hand that you've been using for the scope of your life so far? And it probably would take a lot of motivation. And that's the same thing that we need to keep in mind with our friends when we're asking them to do something that they have never done before or that is completely outside the realm of what seems normal to them, is to really realize that as easy as it is for us to make eye contact or to greet or to give a hello, for them, it might feel as uncomfortable or as unnatural as if I were to ask you to write with your left hand instead of your right hand. And that might be a very hard thing. So even though something seems very easy to us, the amount of effort and concentration that it takes for one of our friends on the spectrum to learn to do something differently always needs to be at the forefront of our mind. And that's my motivation in pairing new skills as something very positive always has to be the focus. And from that is where we plan how we are going to teach, because these kids have to be motivated to want to learn to do something different. Moving on to slide number 14, and again, we've already talked about this, but we have, these skill deficits where maybe their interests are not age appropriate, their skills are perhaps very fragmented, which is very common. I've seen three-year-olds who have no interest to parallel play, but can sit down and follow an 80-step Lego book and build this very elaborate creation that perhaps I probably couldn't even do. And so you have this huge, sometimes you have these areas of profound deficit, but then sometimes they have these abilities that are way beyond their years. And so that's another thing, is if the three-year-olds can't play dress up with another three-year-old, maybe we can use their interest in Legos and pair them with somebody older just so they can start to learn that social interaction and that reciprocity and then start to teach these less preferred skills. So continuing with prerequisites and areas of deficit, it's broken down into three categories for you on slide 15, where we talk about prerequisite skills, tolerating the presence of others, tolerating the noise or the smells and environments, and always, don't be so quick to assume that there's not something in an environment going on because it's not readily obvious to you. Just a quick story. One time I went into a school to consult, and there was this one little boy, and he would spend the whole time circling the playground, covering his ears, screaming, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. No one hit the child. Outside of the playground in the classroom, he was able to interact, but we'd bring him out onto the playground, and there was something in that environment that he could not stand. And we played silent games where kids made zero sounds and there was no screaming or anything obvious. And what it turned out to be was there was a squeak on the swing set. And every time the kids would swing, it really made an annoying noise. Once I focused in on that, just like the little boy on the spectrum did, it became quite annoying. And it was a very easy fix with a can of WD-40 and a couple little squirts, and we fixed that squeaky problem. But the child didn't know what that noise was, and he didn't know how to articulate it. He just knew that it just irked him beyond anything, and the only way to block out that sound was to run around and scream and cover his ears. But it was an easy fix. And as a result, I carry around a bottle of WD-40 with me, because you never know. So, let's see. We are on slide 16 and talking about prerequisite skills still. And we're just circling back around to the slide that we presented earlier and really thinking again about attending and their ability to parallel play. And if they're not able to tolerate being next to a child playing alone, then they're not ready for face-to-face interaction. If they can't play with an activity for 20 seconds, than sustained attention on one activity for 20 seconds. They're not ready for a 4 or 5 minute Candyland game. And when we're teaching like attending skills, for instance, if I have a child who can only play for 30 seconds, can only attend to something for 30 seconds, then that's where we start. And we sometimes build up in increments of 5 seconds. So if you can do it for 30 seconds, fantastic. And then once you can do it for 30 seconds, maybe we're going to work up to 35 seconds and then maybe 40 seconds. Sometimes we can jump ahead a minute, but a lot of times it goes back to what has happened in this child's past. And what I find is that once a child is doing something for 20, 30 seconds, all of a sudden demands are put on them to go from 30 seconds to 5 minutes. And when these kids can learn to do it in very small increments, 20 seconds, 30, 40 seconds, maybe 1 minute, 2 minutes, and then the demand is lifted, it never gets to the point where they are forced to do it for a prolonged period of time, and it becomes aversive. So just 30 seconds, if that's where you're at, fine, I'll take it. And then we'll work to 35 or 45 seconds. So always keep that in mind, too, that our expectations are realistic and very much in line with where these kiddos are. The interest, another area is just looking at the interest that these kids have with their peers. So we never know really what another person thinks or feels when they look at something. And we have to keep that in mind when, we don't know what's going through our friend on the spectrum. We don't know what's going through their head when they're looking at peers. And can they tolerate their presence? And are they even looking at their peers and showing an interest in them? So these are the things that, again, before we can expect them to really sit down and play a game, are they even interested? Does the outside world have any interest to our friend on the spectrum? And if the answer is no, then we have to teach our kids that hey, these outside kids do have value. And so if there is no interest in peers, then maybe, again, the example of taking another peer and giving preferred toys or treats to our friend on the spectrum. So now there's a reason to look at peers because, oh, peers bring me my favorite toy. Peers bring me my snack. Peers might not be so bad. Eye contact is another thing, so just making sure that our friends understand eye contact and are looking around at peers and are looking purposefully rather than just scanning, but that they are looking at peers and just looking purposefully. Another area is inviting others to play. And it might be that after the friend brings, the friend on the spectrum balls 15 or 20 times, that maybe he'll tolerate the presence of that peer. Maybe they can start to share for 1 second at a time or 2 seconds or 3 seconds at a time so that they learn when they hear the word share that it means I give my toy, but then I get it right back. And maybe I give it for a second, and then maybe, we bring it to 2 seconds where he shares his toy for 2 seconds and then 3 seconds and then maybe 4 seconds or transitions to a more preferred toy than what he shared. But it's always important to do these in small increments so that it's always successful and not aversive. Otherwise, you have to go back to pairing. And turn-taking. So turn-taking is easily taught during the initial form of sharing. And, you can have Johnny hand Sam the ball and for 1 second and, great, thanks, that's sharing. That's fantastic. And then we can start to say, okay, Johnny's turn, Sam's turn, Johnny's turn, Sam's turn. And they get the idea of turn-taking, and they learn it correctly. So basic skills, and I think we're about coming to the end of our slides, but these basic beginner social skills. So this is after they've really developed some of these prerequisite skills, and the basic skills that we're looking for, again, is parallel play, tolerating the sounds of their toys, tolerating closer approximations of peers or getting closer themselves to peers, sharing, again, eye contact, and reciprocal interaction. And reciprocal can be answering questions, talking. It can be a peer pointing and somebody else looking at what was pointed to. Anything that involves two people engaging can be considered reciprocal. And think of reciprocal like a circle. So I do something, then it goes to you, and then it circles back around to me and circles back around to you. The more advanced skills, and again, it's important that these skills are expected of our friends in the natural sequence. So prerequisite skills, basic skills, and then more advanced skills. Communication is really considered an advanced skill. And, you know, you have to be able to look at a peer and tolerate their presence before you're able to be close enough to have some form of communication. And communication, asking questions, answering questions, giving details, and really enjoying exchanging information with somebody for the sake of exchanging information. And communication might also include imaginative skills and talking about things that are not here in the present. And for some of our kids, that might be kind of hard. We had one little boy who had no imaginative ability. He just could not imagine. And if he couldn't imagine it or he did not see it in front of him, what you were saying was not true when you were, and it was lying to him. So there is a skill deficit there. And before we could even have him start this communication, we really had to go back and look like, well, what are these prerequisite skills? And we had to address some of those prerequisite skills so he would be effective and successful with communication. Anticipating peers' needs. So this kind of goes back to that sharing idea where you have your friend on the spectrum playing with his preferred toy. He's not necessarily going to understand that the kid next to him looking at that toy means, I really want that toy and please share it with me. For a friend on the spectrum, that kid looking at his toy might signal, oh, I need to jump up and run away because my mom's going to come and yank it out of my hand and give it to this kid. So anticipating the needs of peers goes back to social awareness, eye contact, looking at people, and it takes a lot of skills to anticipate or understand or interpret body language and figure out what you need or why you're staring at my toy or why you're standing so close to me. The other one is self-awareness, so being able to apologize or recognize your own behavior and how it might relate to others or affect others. And we see this also where parents, teachers demand to say you're sorry for bumping into somebody, or they get in trouble for bumping into somebody when they're not even at that point where they have any awareness whatsoever of what they've done. So really punishing a kid for something they've done before they even have that basic skill of awareness really goes back to just pairing things as aversive rather than teaching the skill. So we certainly want to focus more on teaching skills rather than punishing things. Final thought is developing social skills and social awareness is not always as easy as playing appears. Playing looks very simple and easy, but it's actually a very complex, if you break it down to each of its little component parts, there's a lot of complexity in playing. And even though it looks simple, we definitely need to be mindful that kids on the spectrum have very fragmented skills, and they might be very good at assembling a model that a 12-year-old could easily do, but have the communication skills of a 3- or a 4-year-old. So looking at their fragmented skills and areas of deficit and realize that if the child could do it, they probably would. And all behaviors serve a purpose. And they're usually a way to communicate, to get something that they want, or to get out of something that they don't want to do or they find aversive. And if we don't have the skills to appropriately communicate those things, we likely will engage in behaviors that still serve the purpose of communicating, I don't want it, but are generally not acceptable or considered maladaptive. So if we have kids engaging in bad behaviors, maladaptive behaviors, not playing well with others, please avoid looking at the bad behaviors, if you will, as something bad to be punished. But why are they doing that bad thing? Why are they hitting the peer? Why are they hitting themselves? Why are they running away? And start to understand that that is a skill, might be a bad one, might be something that we don't necessarily prefer, but their behavior is a skill that they have developed that is meeting their needs. And the skills that we don't like, the bad behaviors, the maladaptive behaviors, whatever you want to call them, these are things we want to decrease and see go away, but they can only go away if another behavior comes and replaces it. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind, is that all behaviors serve a purpose and help us interact and communicate with our environment. And if we want something to go away because we don't find it appropriate, or it is too loud, too noisy, or just a bad behavior, what's going to replace it? So if we take the bad behaviors away, we've taken away a skill, and if we leave them without a replacement skill, they're going to go back to the old way of doing it, just like crossing our arms, because it's easy, it works, and it feels natural, and I don't know what else to do. Some adult examples, though, when it's just thinking about maybe our own areas of deficit, cooking, algebra, driving a stick shift, asking your boss for a raise, navigating middle school girls, like these are things that for most people that I talk to have been out areas of challenge. Perhaps some of us are still deficit in these areas. And as adults, we have the ability to avoid things or to ask for help or to learn skills, and we have to the same help that we would need as an adult to go back and learn college algebra or to cook a very complex meal. What would that take from us for us to be able to do it successfully? And what do our, when we're looking at the skills and the behavior expectations of our friends on the spectrum, what kind of instruction would they need to learn that successfully? Just keep your own challenges and developing new skills. Always keep them in mind when placing expectations on others to engage in behaviors or activities that they're not necessarily skilled in. We'll have way more success and skill acquisition if we keep learning fun, if we keep goals simple, small, and achievable, and our expectations realistic. And that concludes our presentation. So, Gwen, I will turn it back over to you.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statement. Question number one, this session provided me with education on social skills. Star one, strongly agree. Star two, agree. Star three, disagree. Star four, strongly disagree. Once again, this session provided me with the education on social skills. Star one, strongly agree. Star two, agree. Star three, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause for just a moment. Question number 2. This session informed me on how to assess a child's current social ability. Star 1, strongly agree, star 2, agree, star 3, disagree, star 4, strongly disagree. Once again, this session informed me on how to assess a child's current social ability. Star 1, strongly agree, star 2, agree, star 3, disagree, star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause for just a moment. Question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Once again, overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Or star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause for just a moment. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, if you agree. Star 2, if you do not agree. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, if you agree. Star 2, if you do not agree. We'll pause for just a moment. And question number 5, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with autism. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with autism. Star 2, I am a family member of a child with autism. Or star 3, other. Question number 5 again, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with autism. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with autism. Star 2, I am a family member of a child with autism. Or star 3, other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, press star 1 to have your line open into the conference. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 if you do have a question. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. And once again, that is star 1 if you do have a question or a comment at this time. And there are no questions at this time.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Terry, for providing such wonderful information regarding social skills. Again, if you have questions about therapies discussed today, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to mark your calendars to join our next Autism Awareness Seminar on October 9th at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, when we will be discussing teaching safety awareness to children with autism. Thank you and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, everyone. That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.